You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court, my name is Randall Perdue with the law firm of Timberlake Smith in Stanton, Virginia, and our firm represents the interests of Vicki Parson in this case, both in her individual capacity and as the administrator of the estate of Kenneth Cyrus Coffey. For clarity, I'm going to use the same conventions that I used in my written papers. I will refer to Mr. Coffey as Kenny. I will refer to Vicki, who is Kenny's niece, as Vicki Parson, who is Kenny's niece, as Vicki. And I will refer to Deneen Miller, who is Kenny's daughter, as Deneen. I hope to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Kenny Coffey knew his own mind. If there is one thing that I think that most of the witnesses at trial agreed on, it was the fact that Kenny was a stubborn, opinionated, decisive, and somewhat temperamental man. As his nephew Edward Cox testified, you didn't tell Kenny what to do, Kenny told you what to do. By all accounts, Kenny remained decisive until the day he died. On July 15, 2003, this decisive man executed a last will and testament. He arranged for the witnesses to be at his home to witness the will, the signing of the will, and he directed the witnesses what to do. It is agreed that neither Deneen nor Vicki were present at the signing of the will. Despite this background, Deneen and his daughter has challenged the validity of the will. And that's despite a letter that she wrote to Kenny in which she said, Dad, it is clear that your mind is very strong. And she wrote that letter and delivered it to him around the time that his will was executed. At trial and circuit court, the jury returned a verdict in favor of Deneen on the undue influence claim. Vicki had moved to strike the evidence at the close of all evidence, and had also moved to strike the jury verdict and set aside the jury verdict and enter judgment in her favor because there was no substantial evidence, direct or circumstantial, by which the jury could have found, under the standard of clear and convincing evidence, that Kenny's will was procured by the undue influence of Vicki. This appeal examines two aspects of that case: whether the trial court should have set aside the verdict and entered judgment in favor of Vicki, and whether the trial court's crafted jury instruction on the presumption of undue influence likely caused confusion to the jury, and whether the verdict was based solely upon that presumption. Vicki requested this court reverse the trial court and enter judgment in her favor. There was no direct evidence of undue influence presented by Deneen at the trial. Deneen said herself, I don't know anything that Vicki did.
But they acknowledged that. They hung their hat almost exclusively on the presumption.
That's correct. That's correct. And I think that was the strategy. I think that was the strategy, is to demonstrate the elements of the presumption so that the burden would then be on Vicki to produce evidence tending to rebut the presumption. And we do not object or do not dispute that the presumption applied. We think it barely applied, but we think it didn't apply. The burden remained on Deneen, however, to prove undue influence. In her brief, Deneen argues that she presented circumstantial evidence of undue influence by Vicki. She focuses on three major discrete facts. One is that Vicki purchased a will kit around June 14th of 2013. And that is the will kit that produced the will on July 15th, 2013. Kenny, and the reason that this is taken, this discrete fact out of context, is there were a lot of events that took place between June 14, 2013 and July 15, 2013 that explain why there was no undue influence by this one act. First of all, Kenny did not immediately execute a will around June 14. It was a month elapsed No explanation of where the will was. Presumably, Kenny had it. There was absolutely no push by Vicki to get Kenny to immediately execute a will. There is undisputed evidence that Kenny, again, is the one who arranged for the execution of the will and arranged for the witnesses to be there. There was no evidence provided to explain who drafted the will. That is their second fact. And as we argued in our rebuttal brief, we believe that Deneen is disingenuous on this. Deneen wants to focus on the fact that there is no evidence to explain who drafted the will or who typed up the will, when Deneen herself had in her grasp the opportunity to ask the question at trial, who drafted the will. Her counsel asked her, you don't know who drafted the will, do you? And she said, I know now, indicating that she did not know when the will was drafted, who they would have filled it out. But trial counsel, Deneen's counsel, didn't ask the follow-up question, who was that? Instead, Deneen wants to focus on the absence of the evidence to suggest that that is undue influence. And I suggest that that is much like the situation in the Gill case, where there was the question of the holographic will that was dated in January, and there was some evidence that the challengers wanted to focus on, where one of the witnesses said, I thought I witnessed it in March, and then somebody else said, I thought I witnessed it in February. And then after they came together, they said, oh, yeah, we did it in January. And the challengers wanted to argue that the will was drafted and signed later, but then predated to make it look like it was drafted before his surgery. And finally, they focus on the fact that the names and dates on the will are typewritten, but Kenny did not have a typewriter. By the same token, this is a lack of evidence. This is not positive, affirmative evidence of undue influence by Vicki. Rather, they just merely focus on the fact that there was no evidence of who typed it. There's no evidence that Vicki had a typewriter. That's what we pointed out. They argue that Vicki took care of Kenny's needs, including administering his medications, changing his bed sheets, purchasing his groceries and cleaning his urine bag. Taking care of someone is far from exerting undue influence. At the most, perhaps this indicates that Vicki was there. But as Mary Weimer testified at trial, when she was there and Vicki was there, Vicki was just there. We asked her, did you see Vicki do anything inappropriate to influence Mr. Coffey? And she said, no, when Vicki was there, she was just there.
One of the things that's striking up to me about this case is that it's one thing to have someone who's in a position of trust and confidence, maybe a lawyer, maybe a neighbor, and so who perhaps isn't naturally an object of bounty by the deceased. But when you have someone who's by all the evidence, day in, day out, providing a high level of very demanding care to somebody, then maybe they are in a relationship of trust and confidence, but they also become a more natural object of gratitude and bounty. And I don't know that our cases recognize a distinction between someone who is in a position but isn't necessarily helping or whatever, and this situation where, I mean, it seems like, you know, I would be extraordinarily grateful to someone who's going to that degree of care to help me in my final days. So I don't know if that, I mean, it's not, I don't know if that's before us, but it's a striking difference between this case and some of these other cases.
I think that's correct, and I think that if I'm not mistaken, it was the Redford case, an older case, and I believe there's some language in the Redford case that indicates that when you're talking about the position of fiduciary position that the person holds in regard to the testator, that you are talking about attorneys or bankers or people that are in a professional capacity of fiduciary for the individual. And I believe as the cases have developed, people have looked to situations where there was a power of attorney, for instance. And I think that that goes to how strong would the, and that's why I said at the very beginning, we think that they barely satisfied the criteria for the presumption of undue influence, because I think that goes to, sure, you might be an agent appointed under the power of attorney, but what did you do in regard to that position that led to the procurement of this document? And I believe under the Ayers case, when you're looking at the undue influence applied to a contract or something like that, I believe the test is actually that there has to be a fiduciary relationship, and there must have been something done by that person in the context of that fiduciary relationship that resulted in the instrument that's being challenged.
Does it have to be a fiduciary relationship or a confidential relationship?
I think that the way the court has drafted the language, it has to be a fiduciary relationship or a relationship of dependence. That's the language I believe that I have seen in the case. That's the language.
Do I understand from your last sentence where you said that this barely is sufficient to establish the presumption? That's what I heard you say.
So you
would concede then in this case that the presumption question is not an error. It's what happened after that that is the error that you complain about here today.
That is correct. I don't think I would be here if I was. I don't think I would have gotten rid of. I had claimed that the finding the presumption applied was error.
So from that point forward, the burden remains on the party who is claiming undue influence to rebut the presumption, and that's where your problem is. Your position is that there was no evidence sufficient to rebut the presumption.
I think that
no. What is your position?
Okay, I think that when the presumption arises that there was undue influence, that cases say that there's a burden on the proponent of the document to produce some evidence tending to rebut the presumption, but that the burden of persuasion, the burden of proof, always remains with the contestant
right.
of the will, and that is our position.
All right.
The Chief's point, though, still remains exactly what is the burden going forward. I mean, we have used the expression the courts do, the distinguishing between the burden of production and the burden of persuasion, but that's a very subtle distinction. And if the presumption applies and the burden of going forward leaves everything in equal pose and it's debatable?
I don't believe it leaves everything in equal pose, Your Honor. I believe that in this situation, when the presumption shifts, I mean, the burden of production then goes to the proponent to put some evidence on tending to support. Or I don't think there is any burden of persuasion, so I don't think that the evidence then is in equal pose, because the question is whether or not Bickey presented some evidence that the jury could have found rebutted the presumption.
Let me take you back through the sequence. So you have a legal presumption. That means they don't have to put on any evidence other than the predicates for the presumption, right? Then that shifts the burden, sometimes of persuasion, but not here. Up here only shifts the burden of production or going forward. Now the question is, what is the burden of production for, and could a reasonable fact finder find that burden of production not met? So it appears, quoting from one of our most recent cases, the burden of going forward is with evidence that the transaction was fair, and it rests on the proponent of the transaction, in this case you. So could a reasonable fact finder hear all of the evidence that you've summarized very well and say, you know, I'm not persuaded?
I don't think, Your Honor, that they could have under the standard of clear and convincing evidence. I just certainly don't believe that the evidence that they heard, and I don't believe if that is the case, then what is the standard by which Bickey was supposed to meet that burden for the fact finder? If you're leaving it to the fact finder to determine whether that burden has been met, you are imposing a burden of persuasion on Bickey.
No, that's a very important point. Let's pick that apart. The burden is shifted to your side to come up with a production. In other words, to make it debatable, right?
That's correct.
It's not, the burden doesn't shift and require the burden of persuasion or any sort of going forward beyond simply putting the evidence in play.
That's correct.
So the question is, was the evidence put in play on the subject of the fairness of the transaction? And it's not a question of clear and convincing evidence. That's the proponent's burden. That's the challenger's burden when the challenger loses the presumption that gives him the fiction of it being met anyway, without any evidence on the point. You follow me?
I do, but isn't my read of the case is that the burden is always clear and convincing on the proponent, even if, on the challenger, even if the presumption applies.
So they get a presumption, but they still have to prove the facts that the presumption presumes by clear and convincing evidence? What's the point of a presumption?
I believe, my time is up, I want me to continue to answer the question.
Answer the question.
Okay. I believe that, exactly, yes, because it would still be up to the jury to determine whether or not the court decides, going back, the court decides that the challenger has met the burden of the presumption, that the presumption applies. I still think that it is up to the jury to find, by clear and convincing evidence, that whatever evidence the challenger put on to establish the presumption still constitutes undue influence.
Then what's the point of the presumption?
The point of the presumption is to allow, to raise the inference of the raise the factual inference of undue influence to require the proponent of the document to produce some evidence to rebut the presumption and explain that there was no undue influence.
Yeah, in criminal law, we call that a permissible inference as opposed to a presumption, but we've called it a presumption for a long time in trust and estates law.
Right, and I think that in the Kim versus Commonwealth case, that was discussed, and I think that I have read a lot of several cases where the court has used the term presumption and permissible inference kind of simultaneously in conjunction with each other. And so our position is that, Vicki met her burden of production of evidence tending to rebut the presumption, and therefore the trial court erred by not setting aside the verdict. We'd ask the court to reverse and enter judgment in favor of Vicki Parsons.
I have a question, Chief. It seems like to me, and this is not an unfriendly question, that you didn't directly answer Justice Kelsey's question, because I think what his question was originally is what satisfies the burden of production?
And
you said it, you've already said it in your argument, but you can say it again.
Well, I believe it is putting on some evidence to demonstrate that the will in this case was not procured by undue influence.
Right. So any evidence that you put on that would tend to show there was not undue influence would meet your burden of production?
I believe so. Yes, sir.
Okay.
All right.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Sharp. I'm from the law firm of Botkin Rhodes in Harrisonburg, Virginia. I represent the appellee in this matter, Deneen Miller. This court should uphold the trial court's verdict, which invalidated Kenneth Coffey's will on the basis of undue influence for two reasons. First, Deneen Miller presented sufficient evidence to support the jury's ultimate conclusion that Mr. Coffey's free agency was destroyed and his will was the result of undue influence. And two, the jury instructions issued by the trial court accurately stated the law and clearly informed the jury of the ultimate inquiry.
Assume, hypothetically, you don't get the burden of presumption, that you don't get the presumption because it was properly rebutted under whatever standard. What are the top 5 points that say that a jury could find clear and convincing evidence of undue influence in this case? Factual points.
Yes, Your Honor. I think there's an overwhelming amount of facts. Some of those are related to those three undue influence factors. For 30-plus years, Mr. Coffey had said his property was going to go to Deneen Miller. He was this decisive and determined person, yet in these last 2 months when he was bedridden, dependent, completely vulnerable, he changed his mind 7 days before his death.
That sounds like an inference. He's a strong-willed man. He changed his mind. That's sort of odd. That's not clear and convincing evidence of undue influence. Clear and convincing evidence of undue influence is undue influence. She is persuading him, pleading with him, arguing with him, intimidating him, etc.
Yes, Your Honor. And this court has acknowledged that there can be circumstantial evidence of this undue influence in these cases. That's why we have the presumption in the first place. But if I may go forward, there are several other of these bits of circumstantial evidence that suggest that this was undue influence. As I said, Ms. Parson was taking care of Mr. Coffey in this vulnerable state. She or her husband was there 24/7. Now, Mr. Coffey had stated that he didn't like Miss Parson. For over 20 years, they were neighbors. Miss Parson stated she didn't even trust Mr. Coffey. Now, when this will was procured, even though Miss Parson had knowledge of hallucinations that Mr. Coffey was having, she didn't contact a social worker. She didn't contact an attorney, even though an attorney was brought in.
Help me with the time frame of that. Weren't the hallucinations limited? And I may be mistaken about this, but weren't they rather limited? It basically fixed his medications and then they stopped, and that was well before the will was done. Is that right?
Your Honor, there were, I believe, two accounts of hallucinations. One was would have been before the will was procured. One was after. Now,
okay.
Appellants have said this is inconsistent with the medical reports, but we still have witness okay. testimony that there was an hallucination afterwards. But the point is that he's in this position of weakness, having hallucinations, and this person who's in his care doesn't bother to contact a social worker, doesn't bother to contact an attorney, even though he has an attorney involved in other matters in his life. And most important, I think this is the biggest point, Your Honor, is that around the time the will was procured, Miss Parson approached Mr. Coffey about purchasing his property, and he did not take kindly to that. He did not like it. It upset him. And he told this to Dean Miller, and he told this to another witness, that he didn't like this. And yet, despite the fact that he doesn't like this idea, she goes and procures a will kit from Staples, and about a month later, while he's in this weakened condition, we get this will that we have no idea how it came to be. It's typewritten and filled out. We don't know how it came to be. And this person in a unique position of power over Mr. Coffey is the beneficiary of that will.
One thing Judge Ludwig struggled with, and that I did as well, is that, clearly he's in a physically weakened state. He's dying. He's bedridden and so on. But I was looking for evidence of his mind being weak. And on that, there's precious little. I mean, and there's a lot of evidence to the contrary, that even as he's, you know, getting old and weak and dying, that he was just, I mean, for instance, if you didn't fix his drink exactly the right way with a ratio of ice to water, whatever, you're going right back in the kitchen to fix it right. So there's abundant evidence that as far as his mind goes, that was he was as fierce as he ever was. And I just really didn't see really much of anything. And so if the root of undue influence is your mind, your will was overborne, but his will was as strong as ever, notwithstanding his weakened physical condition, how do we get to, oh, well, but there was undue influence?
Your Honor, it's certainly true that his mind was not completely gone. There was no mental incapacity proven at this time. But there was evidence that his mind was weakened. Certainly we have those hallucinations. Certainly he was on an abundance of medications. He's physically weak, which certainly has an effect on the mind. He's reliant on others. So was he completely gone mentally? No. He had some mental strength left. But the ultimate point is he's in this weakened position. And again, I think that goes back to why we have this presumption of undue influence in the first place. We have a person who's mentally or physically weak, but ultimately they're a vulnerable person. And they're relying on a person who's in a confidential position or in a position of dependence.
That's the whole question in this case, right? So you got this presumption. Opposing counsel doesn't dispute. You met that. So here we are. So then the question is, what happens to that? Does that carry forward throughout, or does it disappear when there's probative evidence to the contrary, which there certainly was? And also, how do we instruct juries on the interplay between this presumption and then the burden of production?
It's an interesting question, Your Honor, and I want to address it, but before I get into it, I think in this case, it's not quite as important, because ultimately we have a jury instruction that told the jury that to show undue influence, the free agency has to be destroyed. Their will has to be overcome. It has to be manifest, irresistible coercion. And the jury, who is in the best position to interpret competing testimony, competing evidence, and observe the witnesses, they answered in the affirmative.
They were also told about a presumption. But if the presumption, in fact, is not properly in front of the jury, that's a problem. If it is properly in front of the jury, you're right. The two together kind of, you know, are pretty airtight.
Yes, and in terms of the presumption being before the jury, this court has said in several cases that the presumption is a jury issue. They said that in Carter, and certainly for a judge to step in and say, as a matter of law, presumption that this matter should be
Did,
court.
Did we squarely say that's a jury issue, or did, it, was it just sort of a, the way the case unfolded and we just described, you know, what had happened?
Well, Carter specifically says that it's a jury that determines if the burden of production to rebut of the presumption is met.
And that brings me to my next question, because here, there, am I correct, there was no instruction to the jury on the rebuttal point?
Somewhat ironically, Your Honor, because Denise Miller, the plaintiff, actually did offer a jury instruction.
Yeah, I noticed that, yeah.
And Parson did not want that instruction.
So Ms. Parsons objected to 18? Is it 18 that you're referring to?
I believe that's 18, the plaintiff's 18, the offered jury instruction. They did not want that instruction. They didn't want any instruction on the presumption of undue influence or its application to begin with. But I think, Your Honor, if we go back to the instruction that was applied, we're getting to that ultimate inquiry, the ultimate inquiry that Whedon talks about, that even once we get to the presumption of undue influence, there has to be some analysis of was the free agency destroyed, was the person's will overcome. The jury was instructed on that, and again, they heard all the evidence, they're in the best position to hear all the evidence, and they answered in the affirmative.
But so without an instruction that tells the jury how this presumption applies, wouldn't you agree that your instruction was incomplete, or the instruction the court crafted was incomplete?
No, I would disagree with that, Your Honor. I think that because the jury was instructed on the ultimate issue, that they determined that Mr. Coffey's will was overcome, that his free agency was destroyed, they're implicitly saying that they didn't buy Ms. Parsons' explanation.
Not necessarily. They could be implicitly saying that, well, you're telling me I should presume this, and I don't see anything that suggests I shouldn't presume it. So I guess that's the way this works. And they take a vote, and next thing you know, you have a verdict.
Somewhat, Your Honor, I somewhat disagree. I think the instruction goes through the presumption of undue influence, and then it says, however, you have to find this ultimate conclusion. This court has talked about, in talking about that burden of production rebuttal, there has to be a satisfactory explanation. And I think the jury, after hearing all the evidence, they clearly were not satisfied with Ms. Parsons' explanation of how this will came to be. She and provided no explanation.
I think it's a potential problem that rebutting the presumption, the jury didn't receive that instruction, but then that's not your fault. I mean, because, so it seems to me it's sort of arguably a problematic way the case unfolded, but that's the law of the case because the proponent of the will objected to the rebuttal instruction.
I would agree with that, Your Honor, and I also think you could argue harmless error in this case where I don't think the burden of production, again, to satisfy was clearly met by Ms. Parsons in this case. Again, there was no explanation of how this will came to be. The appellants have criticized us for not following up on a question. I don't think it's plaintiff's counsel's job to bring out hearsay evidence in that case, and certainly they
did. But it is their job to provide positive evidence of anything that would be indicia of undue influence.
Well,
I mean, that's the problem with it. It's not that the whole fact of the negative information, you can't use that as a basis for showing undue influence when you could have filled a void yourself.
Well, in this case, Your
chose
Honor,
not to.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
Sorry.
At this case, the plaintiff had already met their burden of production in the sense that they met those factors for the undue influence presumption. At that point, the burden of production shifts somewhat to the proponent of the will to explain the situation. So at that point, it is their duty to explain, I don't think they did explain it, and they had the opportunity to ask Ms. Parson who wrote this, and they never asked the question. That was their burden to produce that evidence.
Well, they produced, there's no dispute, they produced ample evidence. So as far as producing it, they did that. Then the question is for the fact finder, did they have to believe that as opposed to your evidence? And then it's just a classic question of, well, who's telling the truth and who's lying? And that's a jury's job.
Correct, Your Honor. And again, the language this court has used in several cases is that there needs to be a satisfactory explanation by the proponent of the will once we have this presumption of undue influence. And I think the jury's decision, when they give this full instruction, is suggesting they were not clearly not satisfied with that explanation.
What about the fact of our Whedon case? Because it seems like to me there's a big question as to whether or not, even if the presumption is not rebutted and the presumption is there, whether or not it is sufficient to prove by clear and convincing evidence that undue influence had indeed robbed this person of their will.
Yes, Your Honor. And this case, I think, is distinguishable from Whedon. In Whedon, we had...
Well, it might be distinguishable, but wouldn't a jury need to be instructed concerning the fact that the presumption in and of itself is not proof of undue influence to the extent necessary for you to prevail in the case?
And I believe they were in this case, Your Honor. So in Whedon, we had a trial court opinion that...
No, but the instruction, why wasn't the instruction there? And if it's not there, isn't that a problem for you?
Your Honor, I believe the instruction was there because in Whedon, the analysis...
Okay, well, point me to the instruction.
Instruction number 8, Your Honor, the instruction that has the undue influence factors at the top, but then below that, that's what gets it Whedon. It says, however, to prove undue influence, there must be a destruction of the free agency, there must be manifest irresistible coercion, and that's what Whedon gets at.
But isn't it inconsistent? Because once you're saying the presumption proves it, and then at the bottom you're saying something else proves undue influence.
Your Honor, that's where Whedon left us, certainly. Whedon says there's this presumption. Whedon said presumption by itself, the trial court opinion in that case, solely relied on the presumption. This court said that wasn't enough because you have to meet that ultimate inquiry. So I think that instruction followed the analysis in Whedon by saying, okay, we have this presumption, but you've got to meet this ultimate inquiry. And it instructed the jury on that ultimate inquiry. And in this case, the jury read that instruction, answered in the affirmative, that yes, that Deneen Miller has met her burden to say this ultimate inquiry, that there has been destruction of free agency, there's been manifest irresistible coercion, and that is enough to invalidate the will. So I think they were properly instructed in accordance with the Whedon analysis.
So are you challenging Whedon in any way? The sentence we're hovering over in Whedon is this one, quote, although a presumption of undue influence was established in the final analysis, the evidence falls short of establishing undue influence by clear and convincing evidence, period. There's no citation for that statement, and arguably it's inconsistent with a host of Virginia cases that preceded it. And the jury, Model Jury Instruction Committee, took the statement face value, put it into the instruction that y'all had. So are you challenging that? Are you conceding that principle, whether it's logical or not, is Virginia law?
Your Honor, for Ms. Miller's purposes, and I see that I have 5 seconds left. Do you mind if I fully answer?
Go ahead and answer the question.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think for Deneen Miller's case, she should prevail either way. I think in her case, with that jury instruction, guiding the jury appropriately about that ultimate inquiry, she's satisfied with the abundance of circumstantial evidence that I think goes beyond just those presumption factors. I think she still meets that clear and convincing standard for whether free agency was destroyed. Now, if you want to argue that she didn't, even though the jury said she did meet that standard, I think you're right. I think the cases before Whedon kind of suggested presumption. That's the purpose of the presumption, is to provide these facts, and then the burden of production shifts to the other side. And if they don't meet it, then the presumption should carry. But certainly, I still think Deneen Miller, looking at Whedon, looking at the abundance of, albeit circumstantial evidence, this court has said is okay, I still think she meets the standard that Whedon has outlined. For those reasons, Your Honor, we ask that you uphold the trial in favor of Deneen Miller.
All right, thank you very much. Call the next case.